The following presentation was recorded at the 2000 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
I raised that question for you. What are your metaphors? What are your perspectives? How do you look at school, at teaching? It's your the way you look at it informs the way you approach it. This morning again, in my Bible reading, I came across a verse that touched, again, the heart of the metaphor that drives me to stand here before you this morning. It's in Joshua 18:3. We're in the Promised Land. Let me give you the setting here a bit. They had come out of bondage from Egypt. The forefathers had gone, the generation before them had gone into the Promised Land to check things out. And they came back and they said, it's a wonderful land, but we can't take it because there are giants there. And as someone has said, when you say that God can't do something through you, that's more of a statement about what you believe about God than it is about you. When you say that God cannot do something through you, you're stating more about your belief of God than about you. So what they were saying was, God, you are not able through us to take this promised land. We are limiting you. And that generation wasted away in the wilderness. And now the next generation came. And they had in fact entered the promised land. They're beyond Jordan now. This is post-Jericho days, post-Ai days. And Joshua said in 18:3, to the children of Israel, how long are ye slack to go to possess the land which the Lord God of your fathers hath given you? Not the land he will give you. He has given it to you. You already, in fact, have it. And so they proceeded to assign some people to go out and survey this land. They walked around the land and they checked out the borders of it, how far it reached, and they actually wrote, you'll find out if you read down through there, leave in verse 9, they wrote in a book the borders of the land. They checked things out. Now, the thing that drives me, Brother Melvin talked several weeks ago about germinate energy, the thing that is the inner core that informs you and drives you, the thing that drives me is this whole idea, the metaphor that teaching is becoming acquainted with your heritage. Becoming acquainted with your heritage. And we have the story of the man who was on his deathbed. He had several sons, and he told these sons, now, the treasure that I have for you is out there in the orchard. And so they went out, and they dug, and they dug, and they dug under the apple trees around the roots. And they dug, but they never found any gold. But the orchard produced like it never produced before. And they became wealthy from the produce of the orchard. And it finally sank in to them. Oh, he meant we're to dig and dung. That is, we're to care for the orchard. That's what he meant. And so the heritage that we have I believe it was Isaiah said that we should walk around Jerusalem, walk about her, tell the towers thereof. Check out Jerusalem. Look out, look at how wonderful it is. And we have a great land to enter into. The problem is that we too often we have eyes that do not see and ears that don't hear. And what burdens a teacher is to recognize that there is a wonderful, valuable heritage for you, but many a person does not even see that there is such a thing. And those that do get a glimpse then wonder, how can I take it? You know, no inheritance that's worthwhile can be gotten, can be taken without some work. It always involves hard work. And so the children of Israel were given the land, but they had to go in there and possess the land. They had to go in and take it and take ownership of it. It's one thing to have something titled over to you, and it's another thing to go in there and take possession of it so that it's yours. And they said there were giants in the land yet. Now, there are several ways we can look at that, and I don't know, sometimes parables work, sometimes they don't. But as we enter our classrooms, we can be assigned to the task. It is, in fact, your room. It's your class. It's been given to you. It's been assigned to you. You have the responsibility for it. Walk around the room. Walk around, survey the land. Survey the fields. The fields of knowledge, the subjects, the material that you have to work with, the students that you're going to have to work with, the facility in which you're going to work. Survey it. Walk about it. Consider the world that we have to live in. Many people write wonderful songs about heaven. They talk about a world not made with hands. And that's very true. It's a wonderful place. But many of those people do not recognize that we are already living in a world not made with hands. The world that you and I are living on today, the air that you and I are breathing, came into existence at the Word of God. And if we want to see God, all we need to do is open our eyes. And the problem is that we are often like the blind man who was given sight. He opened his eyes and he just saw men as trees walking. And then there was the second healing. That's a fascinating miracle, by the way. There was a second application. And then he saw all men clearly. And so, yes, we see the world around us. We see the birds and the bees, and we see the math, and we hear the language, but we see it without perceiving, without comprehension, without seeing what we're looking at. It's one thing to read truth. It's something else to see it. And if we cannot open our eyes and see what is around us, and if we can't see the Lord, and I'm not talking about pantheism at all. I'm talking about seeing the marvels, the intelligence, the providence, the wonders, the power, the care of God in everywhere we look, whether it's the precision of mathematics, whether it's the precision of the movement of the stars in the sky, whether it's the tremendous variety and beauty in the world of nature. If we can't see that, it is sad. Now, as we think of entering then our classrooms, we might also say, well, we can't go in there. There are giants in there. There are giants. There are giants called bored people. The giants of misbehavior. The giants of overwork. The giants of criticism. The giants of stress. I cannot handle these things. And so I will enter timidly, if at all. The authority and power by which we go in to possess the land is not something that comes from ourselves. I remember one minister talking about the children of Israel entering when they crossed Jordan, if you recall, the incident there was a bit different. They didn't use the rod. Instead, I believe the priests carried the ark on a head. Am I right? And the minister used to say, you know, he doesn't think their feet ever got wet. He thinks as they, I don't know if Jordan all opened up at one time or whether it just opened bit by bit ahead of the priests, but it opened. And they went across Jordan in faith. And the big things I'm talking about here, the way, the spirit, and the attitude in which you approach your task, your room, God said he would send a hornet and he would drive them out ahead of them. And don't stretch the analogy too far there into the classroom that the hornets will go. But what I'm saying is that if you go in faith, it's the power and the authority and it's the work of God that can touch the hearts and the minds of those students and give them a spirit of cheerfulness, a spirit of cooperation, a spirit of willingness to learn, a spirit of listening and being teachable. And it's He who can do that. And we go forward in faith. And so we have a tremendous, tremendous world of God to share with our children. And the first thing is for us ourselves to catch that vision. I read a little quote in the book this summer that has intrigued me. It's amazing how one sentence can impact you. And this one says, As we begin to see learning in its true light, it does not lose interest, it gains it. Now here's the sentence. Studies become Jacob's ladder with a constant, two-way concourse, a revelation and response. They become part of the treasure in heaven on which we are to set our hearts. Now he's talking about everything. Who's ever heard of the book Fearfully and Wonderfully Made? All right, wonderful book written by a couple of men. One of them, I believe, was a doctor. And that type of reading is the kind of thing that begins to open your eyes to the fact that it's about the human body. And it talks about the hand and how wonderful a thing as the hand is. And we need to get beyond the point that we use just proof texts and say, yes, God made the hand, and so that was a Christian lesson. Or we study the hand and we study the functioning of physiology, we study anatomy, and then we point out a couple of scriptures and say that the bones will wax jubilant or some other reference that alludes to the fact that God created us. That's fine. Those verses are there, and they're very true. But the fact is that when we study the human body, when we study botany, when we study the deeds of men in history, everywhere we look, we see God. We should. As I get older, I realize more and more how absolutely pervasive the religion of evolutionary humanism imbues most of the things we read. The books are very religious. When you pick it out, you notice it there in encyclopedia articles. A man who looks at life from a mechanistic chance evolutionary point of view, it comes through in every kind of thing he writes, whether it's a news article, whether it's a Supreme Court decision, whether it is a science subject, whether it's a literary piece, poetry, it comes through. because they wear the glasses of coming into existence through chance, purposelessness, hopelessness, meaninglessness, relativistic morals, and so on. I say that to say this. The people of the world, in many ways, have more integrity than we do, because they look at everything they look at through those eyes. So when they study history, and they study math, and they study science, and they study literature, and they decide what to do in politics, they look at everything through those eyes of chance, purposeless, meaningless, make your own meaning. And if we are to be Christian, we need to get to the point that we can at least do that too, that we can have integrity. We do have, the world looks for something to tie together all of life, to make meaning out of life, and they'll never find it. Because the only thing, the only person that does that is Jesus Christ. We already know that. We know that Jesus Christ, in Him, are hid all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, but we don't know what that means. And we don't know how to look at everything and think about everything through those eyes and with that mind. I have been trained and taught over the years to think like most of the people around us think. This idea of that there is such a thing as a neutral subject or a secular subject. Now, I wasn't taught that purposefully. That language wasn't used, but that's the way we think. I realized from my early years of teaching that this was a problem. And the idea of integration, I heard talked about this very second year I taught. But I was not taught that way. And I'm not sure I will ever be able to teach that way, as I should. But I see that there's something there. I told my sons recently, maybe there's hope for the next generation to really see everything that way. Now, I'm working at it. Why did I talk like this? Well, there is so much. There's so much there. And if you want to know the degree to which a person sees Jesus and God and the things around him, look to the degree in which he is cheerful and enlightened, or I'd say the opposite of that. If a person is bored, uninterested, sees no purpose in various subjects, he just hasn't seen it. He hasn't seen it. Well, I run the risk here of talking in generalities. I'm not sure whether I connected with you. Like I said yesterday, I actually just put it in gear and started driving. I'm not sure whether I hooked up to you before I left. So I'm not sure you're with me or not. And so you may not be sure where I am. I'm out there somewhere in that field and you're wondering what's going on here. That's okay. I'll let that go, and at least that's what happens with people sometimes. You know that they're bothered with something, or they're talking about something they're not quite sure what they're talking about. So if that happened, we'll let that as it is. But suffice to say that there is wonder. There is wonder, and if we believe that we just have to kind of put up with things while we're in this life until we get to heaven, then everything will be wonderful. We haven't really found the power and the joy that can come from serving Christ in everyday life, and that includes the classroom, and that includes all the mundane things like washing dishes and sweeping the floor. This morning, we want to look together at some training principles and also some thoughts about understanding children. And then also we'll look at the characteristics of 9 to 11-year-olds. And we'll begin with the training characteristics. Now, there was a sheet passed out, and you should each have one, that says some principles of child training. If you didn't get one, raise your hand. All right, there's one came in back there just since you passed it out. I'd like to, first of all, before we go down through this sheet, I'd like to point out to you some of the comparisons and compare and contrast teaching and training. It's imperative that you know, as you walk into the classroom, whether you're teaching or whether you're training. Many people try to teach without training, and you're wasting your time if you do that. Many people try to train without teaching, and you can do that, but you run into great problems later. If you train someone, the person will do, if you truly train him, he will do what you train him to do. But then, later on, he may not be able to do what he has to do. And if you teach him and don't train him, he may have the understanding, but you may, in fact, increase his guilt or increase the things he does by not training. For example, a man's heart who is set in him to do evil and would like to destroy it. Suppose you gave him a lesson on bomb construction and told him how awful this could be if you constructed one. What do you suppose he would do? Well, he would go and build a bomb. Of course he would. And so you'd be a fool to teach him how to build a bomb. And if people are doing things, and we see that around us with drug education, for example, and if you tell these people, now look, this drug has this results, and these have these results, and you oughtn't to do this because you'll die, or whatever. Depending on the person's heart, he will go right out and do it. In fact, he can do it more efficiently and better because he knows exactly which thing to buy to do what he wants to do. And so, you do not teach somebody. There's some things you ought not to teach. Well, teaching has to do with knowledge, and training has to do with skill. When you teach, you are primarily working with knowledge, and with training, you are developing a skill. Teaching has to do with the understanding, opening the understanding, developing the understanding of the person. And training causes him somehow to do. One of the biggest problems with working with young children is that people try to teach young children before they train them or even in the absence of training. And it doesn't make any difference how well you can explain to Johnny how it feels when he pests his sister or pokes her with a pin. You can explain the operation of the nervous system and the degree of pain that that makes and how serious that is. And so he understands it very well. And you can have the understanding wide open. Will Johnny stop poking here with a pin? Well, if he does, it won't be because of what you taught him, that's for sure. It will be because of something else, something having to do with his heart or what he would like to do. And so, let me go down the list. Teaching deals very much with the mind, the understanding. Training has to do with the heart, with the will. Teaching has to do with dispelling ignorance. Training has to do with developing an ability. Ignorance, by the way, is not a bad word. Ignorance means unknowing. And you and I should be ignorant of many things. We shouldn't be proud of our ignorance, but we should be happy of our ignorance. Things that we have no knowledge of. And I don't want to know about that. I want to be ignorant in many areas. The Bible calls it simple concerning evil. Wise concerning the good, simple concerning the evil. And so unknowing. Teaching deals with pushing back, they say, the walls of ignorance. Training develops an ability. And so what do you do as a teacher? When you teach, you explain, you enlighten, you illustrate, you tell, you do whatever you have to do to open the person's understanding. Make comparisons, give illustrations, show him things, anything at all that will help him to understand what you're talking about. When you train, You use such things as commands, directions, and your influence, and you call someone to do something often enough and well enough so that he in fact does it and is able to do it. Now, the Bible would show us, if you check it out, that training comes first. Obeying and doing comes first before the understanding. And in many cases. Now, of course, we could discuss that for a while. But by and large, the direction is to obey. He who does is the person who will understand. And that's the way in which our approach to Christian teaching is the opposite of the approach of the world around us. And that is that we must do. And as you do, you understand. And there are, and since much truth has to do with activity, if not all truth has to do with activity, something you do, and that's especially true with us as Anabaptists, we've always taught that you need to do. It doesn't matter much what you say if you don't do it. And so, doing, it's in the doing that the understanding is opened. In fact, there's quite a judgment on the person who understands and doesn't do. The Bible talks about people who hold the truth in unrighteousness. It becomes a liability if you know the truth and do not do it. All right, so anyway, when we teach, we're dealing with the understanding. And so, yes, when these things get out of balance, you'll hear expressions like, how many times have I told you? Didn't I tell you you shouldn't do that? Oh, there it is again. See what the results are. Oh, that's going to happen again. There he did it again. Well, that kind of nagging and nagging at the understanding. Yes, the child knows that very well. And he'll probably do it again too. And he doesn't really care that much that it broke and made the floor wet or whatever. He needs to be trained. The Bible talks about bringing up your children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And if you're a babysitter or a parent, one of the expressions that is very blunt that you'll sometimes hear is, see that they behave. Yes. How? Well, do it. Make sure they behave. That's called training. How am I going to do that? Hey, there's no formula. People are different, but it's the power, the authority. You know, authority is a fascinating, fascinating thing. It has nothing to do with the size of the person, with the age of the person, with the sex of the person, with the years' experience of the person. I've seen little, short people, big, tall people who, when they work with children, they have authority. They speak and the children respond. I've seen the same thing with big people, little people who are just the opposite. You can speak and the children will laugh. And there's... Anyway, let's look at the paper here now. Some principles of child training. This is taken from Andrew Murray's book, now out of print, adapted from that, on how to raise your children for Christ. And he points out here to those working with children that training is more than teaching. And he outlines here in point number one what I went through in the overhead. But basically points out that training somehow sees that he does it well enough and often enough that it becomes a part of him. And then moving on, lead the child. Here's a key, especially as you work with young children. Try it with all of them, but when you get the young children coming to school, lead the child to know that he can obey. Yes, you can do right, and you can do it easily. It is easy to do right. You know the old saying, it takes fewer muscles to smile than it does to frown. It does. It takes less energy to smile than it does to frown. you hold a smile for 5 minutes, hold a frown for 5 minutes, and see how your face feels after each one. You can easily do right. And furthermore, you can delight in doing right. Now, there's a goal for you. Have your children develop the attitude that I can do right, I can easily do right, and I can delight in doing right. These are some of the big, big foundational attitudes to develop. Third one, habits come first. Habits come first. Now, this is not behaviorist. This is saying that you train to do right, and when a child obeys and is cheerful and kind, regardless of why a little child does that, he automatically reaps the benefits, the blessings that go with that. If you stand in the sunlight, you get warm. It doesn't matter why you're standing there. If somebody pushed you there, or if you walk there to see what it was like, if you're there, you get warm. Now, I'm not saying that you should force them into these things, but what I'm saying is that when a child does right, automatically he reaps the benefits of being kind, taking turns, and so on. And then, in the fourth item, feelings. When you work with young children especially, remember, they are bundles of feelings, especially about third grade girls. I'm not talking down or poking fun at them when I say that. I'm just saying you need to understand. Some of them will come to school, and the major thing, the big, big thing that's on their mind is, what are my friends going to think of me today? Who will I be able to sit with at lunch? These feelings are very vital. Amen, anybody? Yes. All right. Now, that's not bad. You see, you need to be aware of that, and you need to realize if you're trying to do the majority of your work with the intellect, you don't get to first base until you think about feelings first. You've got to work with what you have. You must work with what you have. And there are, and so you want to, this third sentence here, the wise parent and the wise teacher creates a feeling favorable to the good to make it attractive and desirable. Make them want, cultivate these feelings that they want to do the right. They want to be pleasant. Without this, habits have little value. With it, they have a connecting link by which they enter and grow into the will. Yes, you can develop habits in children. If you have a heavy enough stick or a fast enough stick, you can get children to do about anything you want to do. You can make habits. But habits alone are not enough. Don't get me wrong. You've got to work with love and with the feelings. But you do have to train. Moving on to five. Example. The last sentence of that, you know, it isn't what you say, it's what you as a teacher do. And I don't know what the percentage is, but probably the biggest part of you being successful in your classroom is becoming the person that you need to be, being what you need to be before the students. It is by living the Christ life that we prove that we love it, that we have it, and thus will influence the young mind to live it and to have it too. If Jesus were teaching this year, if somehow the board had been able to sign him up to come into your classroom and do the year, do you think that there would be any back talk, any laziness, any of the other kinds of problems? Yes, I believe there would be. I believe that children would be children. He would allow them to be children. But he would know how to meet it. He would know how to deal with it. Now, I say that to say this. Does Jesus live in you or doesn't he? The fact is that they could sign Jesus up for this year. Now, don't take that literally, but I mean that, you know, how big is our faith? When we say, well, yes, he could do it, but I can't. Again, what are we saying something about ourselves, or are we saying something about God? Or about our willingness to allow him to work? Anyway, we example is vital. Number six, love is vital. Love is vital. I'll go down to the middle there. Love gives itself with its thought and strength to live for and in the other and breathes its own stronger and better life into the weaker one. You actually need to give. At the end of the day, if you've done your work, you will feel, as Jesus did when the woman touched him, you will feel that virtue went out of you. And you will feel drained. Something left you. But it wasn't in vain. It wasn't in vain. Now, it's also possible to feel drained for other reasons. But there is a healthy kind of tiredness that you feel after a day, after a hard day's work. Love inspires, and it is inspiration that is the secret of training. Notice, not the secret of teaching here. That's the secret of teaching, probably too, but the secret of training. How can you get the person to, when you say jump, why would he jump? Why would he do it? When you say take out your pencils and write, why would he do it? Is it because they're afraid you'll punish them? Is it because they love you? Why would they do it? Well, somehow, we don't need to see our Western minds. We want to analyze that and figure out just what it is that makes them do it. We don't need to do that today. Love is the strongest, what should we call it, power, living thing, force thing. Seems like too wonderful a thing to call a thing. But anyway, love is the strongest thing in the world. It's stronger than death. It's the one thing that will go on forever. And love your children. And do you know what? You have no choice but to love them. If you're a Christian, you will love them. But you also ought to cultivate the attitude of liking them. Learn to like your children. Do you like being with them? Do you feel better when they arrive than you did before they arrived? Or do you feel better in the afternoon when they all go home? Well, we do have different feelings when they go home because we're tired. But it shouldn't be that, well, yes, I'm here at school these 2 weeks working, and things are going fine. This year could just be fine if the children wouldn't come. No, if you like them, it should, when they walk in the room and are ready to start learning, that should energize you. Jesus said, my meat, that is my food, the thing that gives me my strength is to do the will of Him that sent me. And so, when we are doing the work for God, it's the work that gives us the strength. That's a fascinating one, but that's true. That's what energizes us. You know very well that it isn't primarily protein and carbohydrates that give you your energy, because you can eat all you want and be very languid, very listless, very purposeless. Take something much more than that. Now, let me go through this paragraph at the bottom of this carefully. Christ-like training is not manipulation or behavior modification. When you manipulate somebody, you do what you have to get him to do what you want him to do. And if you modify the behavior, you do again what you have to do to get them to behave. And so you offer them whatever. You find out what will make them jump the highest, and that's what you do. Whatever it is, punishment, reward, and so on. Going on, it does not control children by taking advantage of their innocence. See, a child is innocent and unlearned in many ways. And so you are more intelligent, you have more experience than he has, and so you can take advantage of that and get him to do things that he otherwise would not do by tricking him, so to speak. That's a little baby. Why, if you want something and you just put it out of his sight, he stops wanting it. And so I'm not saying that you shouldn't do that with a baby. What I'm saying is you train children. Or you don't take advantage of their simplicity, their ignorance, or their trust. The fact that a child trusts you, you don't take advantage of that to get him to do what you want to do. And you don't take advantage of your own size or your own strength or your own power to give him rewards. But Christ-like training It does two things. It inspires, but it doesn't depend on that. It doesn't say, it doesn't think that just because I'm cheerful and happy and have wonderful devotions in the morning and am all excited about God's world, it doesn't assume that they're going to then behave and get interested in learning. No, not at all. It recognizes that you're going to have to require. I want you to do this. And I want you to do that right. You can do better than that. You need both of those. It inspires, requires. It shows how to do something, but it also helps. Comes back and helps you to do it. It gives you hope. And that's what children really want. And that's what you want too as a teacher, don't you? You want hope. You want to see how this could be done. And you know, that's really the biggest thing you need as a teacher. When they built the Tower of Babel, they could do it. Fascinating story. God came down himself. And this is God's analysis. He walked around the building site. He checked things out. And here's his conclusion. He said, this they've started to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them, which they imagine to do. Can you imagine that? So he said, we're going to have to do something about this. And so he confounded the language, and they scattered, and people have been scattering ever since. They're still scattering today. Families, homes, churches, communities, ethnic groups are scattering ever since. Now, what's amazing is that even under that curse, it's amazing what men have been able to imagine and make. And so the things that we see happening, the technology, the inventions we see happening, are what men have been able to do even under that curse of having the language confounded. Now, lest to go too far in that rabbit trail, let me say this, that so really what you need as a teacher is hope. You need some vision, some sight of what can be. And that's at least half of it. If you can't imagine how you could do this, or you can't imagine what a good classroom spirit would be, you'll never work towards it. If you can't imagine how you'd do it, or how you'd go about doing it, you'll never work for it, because you can't imagine. But you know that if you want to build something, if you want to make something, if you can figure out how this thing could be done, that's the biggest part. Now, it might require more money than you have. It might require more time. But the imagination, that is the seeing, the vision, the hope comes first. And so your children, if they're supposed to do their work, they're supposed to learn something, they're supposed to master something, they need hope. They need to see that this really can be. Maybe they need models of other children's work to see. Maybe they need an older child to give a testimony. Yes, I didn't think I could learn my multiplication tables either, but I did. All right. Christ-like training is consistent. It's purposeful, has a definite goal, and the definite goal is not just a certain kind of behavior, but it's to come into the Christ-like behavior, an image of Christ, to be alive and engaging life around you, caring about the people around you, cheerful, friendly, to be what a person should be. It does not depend on some method. It does not depend on the child's cooperation, saying that, well, if he cooperates, I can teach. If he can't, I can't. It doesn't depend on your skill. And it doesn't depend on saying, well, God, if anything's going to happen here, I guess you'll have to do it. Well, God does it all. But, my friend, most of what God does, it seems, he does through people. One of the most fascinating sermons that I heard in the last decade was the story of Moses on the mountain with God. And you would think that when he was up there getting the Ten Commandments, written in stone, history being made, Nothing ever like it before or since in the world. That a man went up on the mountain with God and God wrote the stones. Now you would think when a man of God is doing such an important work that God, with his ability, his omnipotence and his power, could easily take care of a few things for him in the meanwhile. Now, if you remember the story, you remember that in the middle of this giving of the Ten Commandments, God said to Moses, by the way, Moses, we're going to have a little interruption here, a little break. Your people down there are misbehaving. And you're going to have to go and take care of it. And so Moses went down, he and Joshua, and you know the story. They found the children of Israel had built a calf. And so he had to deal with it. He had them drink it in water. And he dealt with that. When that was all over, he came back up on the mountain with God, and they had to write the commandments again. Now, did God deal with the children of Israel that time? Yes, he did. But he did it through Moses. Don't ever think, as a teacher or as a parent or a preacher, that these things I'm doing here are so important, so godly, so religious, so wonderful, that God will take care of some of these other things over here about some of this unrest or this misbehavior or this whatever's happening over here. Surely, if I'm doing such an important thing here, I'm memorizing my scripture or whatever it is, planning the Bible lessons, that he'll take care of these things. No, don't expect God to do mystically somehow from a cloud what he wants to do through you. It's very mundane. It's very everyday. It's very earthy. It involves talking to people. It involves God working through you. And so the bottom line here, back to this paragraph, Christ-like training obeys and serves both the Lord and his children lovingly and faithfully, trusting God to honor his word. What I'm saying is that we do not have a particular kind of behavior that we see that everybody has to do this thing in this way for all time. Yes, we do want them to be kind and so on, but we teach because we're responsible to teach. We train because we're responsible to train. So we obey God faithfully and cheerfully and lovingly. So we serve God by doing that. We also serve the child as a child of God. We serve the child, meeting his needs, and serving a child means giving him teaching, giving him training, helping him understand. And we trust that as we do that, we don't understand how it works, but God then opens the understanding and he makes our word count. We trust God to honor his word. And if we've been faithful and done the best we can, tried to do the best we can in training and teaching, we do it to God, and some children will not turn out the way we want to see them turn out. They will not. You will have some children go through your room who just don't like you. Don't appreciate your style of teaching, perhaps. This can happen. And some who will grieve your heart in later years. But my friends, that's the story of life. Some people who met Jesus did that too. And he grieves over people. And if we're faithful, as we teach, you do not measure your success of your teaching by the percentage of your children that, quote, turn out well, or whether they turn out well or poorly. You measure by whether you were faithful, by whether you did it unto the Lord and were happy when things turn out well. But when they don't, we keep our eye on God and continue to serve him. I'd like to continue on down this sheet with some thoughts here on understanding the students you serve. Looking at children in general, we could say that children have affections, and they are going to set them on something or someone. They are affectionate, and they're going to set their affections on people or things. We need to be aware of that. That's children are affectionate. They respond to affection, and they will set them on something. Children also have their own personal giants, their own Goliaths that they face, their own Red Seas that they must cross. We all had them. What I mean is an impossible circumstance. I am left-handed. Because I'm left-handed, I'm different. There's something wrong with me. Now, I just touched on something there. It could be anything. But there's something different about me than most people. With some children, that is, well, that's a condition. And it can't change. And therefore, my life is going to be miserable, more or less, because of whatever that condition is. Maybe I'm too short. Maybe I'm too tall, too heavy, too light, too skinny. Have a lot of pimples. Whatever it is, it can be a that kind of thing. Or it can be a habit kind of thing. Well, I'm just jumpy, or I'm just talkative, or whatever. They have these quiet inner things that I will never be able to overcome, or that's just the way, or a family circumstance, father, mother, or some family situation. There's some big problem. All children have some more or less. And part of it's just growing up. And you'd never ever want to belittle a child's problem. You never want to let on that. When I was 14, I used to think too that people didn't understand me. But you'll get over that. That's not so bad. Hey, excuse me. It is bad. It is bad. When you're 14, you're 14. You're not 50 or 20 or 30. And it is bad. It's hard. It's a very personal, very present problem. And so at least you need to let children know that you understand. And you might not know what his problem is. You don't have to dig in to find out what that is. But be aware that he has one, and don't make light of it. Don't think, well, it's just a child problem. You'll grow out of that. Well, maybe he will grow out of it. But it's not just a light problem. It's as big to him as whatever problem that you're facing is to you. And that relates to the next one. Everyone has baggage. He lives in a context. Life involves relationships. And so everyone has some kind of an environment that he lives in. The church, home, community, parents. And that influences him to some extent, for good or for worse, toward learning, against learning, whatever. And if you're aware a little bit of that environment, the more you're aware of that, it helps you to understand what makes him tick, how he approaches playing, how he approaches other children, and so on. And if you disregard his background, why you, in a sense, cause him to disintegrate, that is, if you don't want to create two worlds for the child, that the school world is totally unrelated to the rest of life, and real life is out here, and school is kind of an unreal, artificial thing that you live in for a while, and then you want to, if you understand about the community and the way of life in the community and the kind of employment of the parents and the homes and so on, you somehow want to help him to integrate the things he learns and his views of life into what he needs when he lives in the community that he lives in. Now, an extreme, of course, would be if you would teach somebody, if you went to somebody in a foreign culture, in a foreign country, and you taught him all your own things. You taught him in French, and he's going to have to live in Germany. Why? Obviously, you wouldn't be preparing him for where he needs to live. Children
are responders. They're responding. They react. And they're going to respond to you in at least two ways. They're going to have a personal response to you as a person. As a person. And then they'll respond to you as a teacher. That is, how you go about teaching. And some people get along just fine with children and are wonderful. But when it comes to starting teaching, because of their methods or the lack of method or whatever, it doesn't work very well. And the flip can be true. A child may appreciate your teaching ability and what you do as a teacher and that he learns from you, but he really might not care that much for you as a person, to put it bluntly. I mean, maybe his personality doesn't mesh with yours or whatever. But anyway, just think of both those areas. He's going to respond to the school and its environment, to his classmates, and mark this down or highlight it. It's quite possible that the classmates are much more meaningful, influential to him than anything you do in school or any lessons or any activities. I mean, some children come to school to be with their friends. That's it. Now, other things happen at school, but that's really kind of beside the point. They like to be with their friends. And you need to work with this. When I say work with it, I mean that's the context in which you need to teach. You need to realize that Michael back there is more interested in the friends than he is in anything I have to say. And so, well, we have to accept that. Right, Michael? Okay. And of course, they're going to respond to the curriculum, for good or for bad. Children also worship. They really do set their affections. When you worship something, why, you look to that thing to provide for you what you really need in life, in your deepest areas. You look to that thing or person to provide security for you, to provide your sustenance. If something is your Lord, it's your bread keeper. The word Lord means the person who keeps the bread and dispenses the bread. So we had the Lord of the manor in the Middle Ages. He's the person who controlled the food supply. And your Lord is the one then who gives you what you need. And little, it's appropriate for little children to look at their parent as the Lord. He's God to them, because the parent cares for them, provides for them, gives them basically everything. They would die without the parent. And as the younger children come to school, they set their affections and they worship something. And you want to encourage them to not have idols. That is, to set their affections, to look for purpose, to look for life in things that can't give it. Things that can't give it. And so they shouldn't worship their peers. And they shouldn't worship ungodly heroes. Or they shouldn't worship something like work, thinking that if I just work hard enough, that's what life is about, doing enough work. They shouldn't look for hope and purpose in anything other than God. Now, you do want to point them to worthy models and people who did heroic things. Now, it's not the people they worship, but hold up good models for them. Read aloud to them good examples. Another thing that children certainly do want is something that's worthwhile. There's a story of the teacher who was assigning composition after composition, and there's one girl, she was sure had ability to write and never did much in composition. And one day she took her aside and asked her, "Now, what's with this? I know you can write better than that." And the girl said, "Well, you never gave us any assignment that mattered." I think that's what it was. The things you asked to write about didn't really matter. And she couldn't really put her heart into writing, because you can only write so many times about what you did last summer or what you're going to do next summer. And they want worthwhile activity. And they will find fulfillment in activities without having to analyze why they're doing everything. They like activity. They have curiosity. They like relationship. They like challenges. And so some of the things that they enjoy doing you might not think are worthwhile. And of course, that doesn't mean that just because they enjoy doing something, you do it. But they do think about that. How what can the child see that's worthwhile in here? You want to win the child's heart. And, you know, what comes from the heart goes to the heart. What comes from the mind goes to the mind. So if you teach from the mind, you pretty well reach the mind of the child. And that's about it. If you want to reach his heart, to get his heart into his work, you need to teach also from the heart and have your heart in the work. And that's what you will. If you put your heart and mind and soul and spirit, you love God with all of those, and you also serve your students with a willing heart, a willing mind, they will respond in kind. You'll get the echo of whatever you send out. If you send out the heart, you will get it. They'll respond from the heart. Carry him on your heart. There's a beautiful illustration in the Old Testament how the priests carried 12 stones. I believe both on their shoulders and on the breastplate it was. And one of them, I think, was the 12 stones were for the 12 tribes, and one was to illustrate, I think, the responsibility or carrying. But the other one on the breastplate, they carried them close to their heart. Now, the analogy would be, and you could do this concretely if you'd want to, you could carry your students' names in on your heart, in your shirt pocket. I carried for some years in my little plane book a group picture of my students. Do you care about these people? It's easy to think of teaching as dealing with program, with curriculum, checking papers, all the clerical work, bulletin boards, managing, routines. But really, friends, it really deals with people, and you ought to even use that term. You want to think of the individuals, and these people have names and faces. So you yourself can put names to the people you work with, whether it's Mary, Sue, George, Bob, Sam. We need to get personal about this. God is very personal with us. Think of the individual. Love the person. You need to care about him, but leave the issue up to God. It's very easy to get your focus on the class. And, well, you do need to, in a way. But remember, the attitude we have is so important. We need to serve God. We're really doing it to before God. We're serving God. And so we love, we do what we can with the children. We leave the results with God. And our primary work is not to impart information, but to love and serve God by serving his child. And that's how we as teachers serve God. Just like if somebody gives you a cup of cold water in the name of Christ, you're actually getting it from Christ. Christ is giving it to you through a person. And so we wonder sometimes, oh, Lord, you've done so much for us. What can we do for you? Well, it has to do with serving other people. When you serve other people, you are serving God. And so you're serving him by doing that. Philippians 1. Paul, this, if you read through the epistles of Paul, scan through those epistles sometimes, and we think of these epistles as being heavy theological treatises. And in fact, they are that. Peter said that Paul writes many things that are hard to be understood, and some people wrest those things to their destruction. But all through his writings, Paul is very personal. And he opens up Philippians and says, I thank God every time I happen to think about you. Every time you come into my mind, I say, oh, thank you, God, for those people. Always in every prayer of mine for you all, making request with joy. Now catch that. We talk about cultivating a spirit of cheerfulness in the room. What about cultivating a spirit of cheerfulness in ourselves and our own hearts? Every time you happen to think of your class at home. Now I'm speaking to myself here. This is a challenge. Do you say, every time my class of students happens to cross my mind, I thank God. I thank God. And whenever I pray, I pray for them, not with heaviness, not with despair, but with joy. By the way, let me give you, I won't charge you for this, let me give you one of my pet peeves. There's one word that I think should be considered almost sacrilegious for a Christian to use when he prays. It's a four-letter word that starts with J. Does anybody know what it is? Just. When I hear a person pray and I hear the word just, it just grinds every time I hear that word used. Why? When you pray, you're saying to God, Lord, I really don't want to bother you here, but if you could just give a little bit here, touch this person's heart here. Maybe I'm not really entitled to ask this, but would you please do a little here and do a little there? If that's the way you pray, that's about what you should expect to get, just a little here and just a little there. That is not the way we're instructed to pray. Paul tells us that he is able to do exceedingly, abundantly, above what we can ask or think. Now, we talked about imagination a bit ago. You imagine as big as you can, and you haven't even begun to touch what he can do. And so, the reason our results are not great enough is our prayers are not great enough. We don't really expect. Well, that's the subject of prayer, but how big are your prayers? Do you really believe that God can open your understanding so that you can teach, so that you can explain, so that you can understand the children? Do you believe that they can be cheerful? Try to purge your mind of that word just when you pray. It's hard. You'll feel awkward when you say something like, Lord, make our room one full of good cheer, where the children come in with joy and go out with joy. And this vision I have, multiply it, make it bigger, do far beyond what I'm able to ask. I challenge you to pray biblically like that. And one other passage related to this, and being very personal, caring about the individual. The book of Romans has, I believe, 16 chapters. I commented this earlier this summer, so some of you heard it. And roughly the chapters are about the same length. But 1/16th of the book of Romans. Who can tell me the major content of chapter 16 of Romans? Anybody? The last chapter. You should remember the last one you remember the beginnings and endings the best. Now, we know all about Romans 8 and Romans 6 and 7. What's in Romans 16? A bunch of names. That's right. If your name was in there, you would know what was in it. My point, you read through that pretty devotion sometime. You say, why read all those names? Do you ever wonder why some of those lists are in the Bible? Well, Paul goes down the list here and he says, greet this person, greet that person, remember this person, remember that person, remember this household and that household. The point is that Paul was very, very personal when he thought about the church at wherever, Corinth or Philippi. He didn't think about some bunch of people there, some community. He actually thought about individuals. Now, he probably didn't know everybody, but he thought in terms of people. And so what I'm saying is, as you think of your students, think of the people. Learn to know the people. Remember that when you teach, yes, you find yourself here. And that's one of the things in a setting like this that's a disadvantage. There isn't the time nor the numbers here for me to really know your names. But if we were going to spend a year together, that would be one of the primary things to start doing, to learn to know something about you as people, as individuals. It's always God's mind, always God's will to have wisdom. We mentioned that yesterday. And you receive, at the bottom, you receive your confirmation and blessing from God, not the child's behavior. Beware of trying to find purpose and fulfillment through your children. My friends, you will run into trouble sooner or later, and probably sooner. Some people teach because they love working with children. Children are so responsive, especially if you have the perfect group is about grades 4 and 5. There are no problems in those grades. First, second, and third, you have to start them out, and then they have the foundation laid, and then once you get into 6 and 7 and 8, well, then they hit the rapids. But now, and sometimes those fourth, and I'm exaggerating. Those of you who teach from fifth grade know that they're very real. But what I'm saying is this. Sometimes children, they can be so wonderful, and delightful to teach, and you have a lot of fun with them. And that's good. That's fine to do that. But that can't be the source, the foundation of your joy in teaching. Your source, your foundation, the bottom line is that you are serving God and you find your confirmation and your blessing from God. Now, He may send some of it through the children. But if things do not turn out well and you don't have a good year, that does not mean if you've been depending on that to provide your joy and your satisfaction, your purpose in teaching, then you're going to have a hard lesson to learn. So keep your eye on the Lord, and you do enjoy the things that happen in the room, but that's not why we teach, because that's not the primary reason. And that's what my last comment there is there. Don't try to find fulfillment in children's behavior, learning, and response. Your fulfillment is in the Lord. Be sure that you love them unconditionally, not for their performance. And that's especially true with a talented child. I'd like to turn now to the back side of yesterday's sheet on characteristics of the 9 to 11-year-old, the child who's in grades 4, 5, or 6. And if you don't have one of those sheets from yesterday, I don't believe I have the extras along here today. I'll see that you get one, though. Who does not have a sheet that has characteristics of... All right. I thought I brought those extras along, but I don't. All right. Let me go over this list briefly. Your 9 to 11-year-old, he's, again, very active. And so one thing to remember is that he'll try about anything he puts his heart to, as long as it's not work. If he perceives that this is work, all of a sudden he doesn't want to do it anymore. And that includes reading a book. He might enjoy reading the book, but if he has to do a book report on it, why, all of a sudden it takes all the joy out of reading the book. Well, you want to... Be aware of that. He's active. He likes to do things. Come up with a variety of constructive activities. Remember, he's a doer. So give him a variety of things to do. And he is strong. He is healthy. So if possible, give him some difficult jobs. Now, the strength might not mean necessarily physical strength, but he likes challenges. He is careless about his looks, and that's one of those things that's not overly serious. However, there may be some, you may need to give some little private lessons or even to the parent on hygiene. It can be one of the hardest things you have to do, to talk to somebody or to his parent about something so personal as personal hygiene, but sometimes it must be done. You must do it, for they will really appreciate it, and so will the other children. He's a doer. He likes to do things. And also, he is noisy. And the fowls especially, they like to fight and wrestle and tussle. That's a characteristic of that age. It really is it's partly a kind of affection. The physical contact can be. And that does not mean you allow them to do it, but you understand where they're coming from. If you see them grappling, it's probably not You don't automatically think that somebody's mad at somebody or somebody did something and he's trying to get him back. They may be simply, while the girls stand and over here and whisper together, the boys go over there and tussle, and it's just their counterpart of that. It's the boy thing to do. He is tends to be restless, and he likes difficult and competitive things, and so give him challenges. Challenge him with projects, with games, with extra. One teacher had up on the wall one year she found out in a book how many ways you can make change for a $1 bill. And I'm not sure what the number was, 6,000 something. So they throughout the year, the children worked on this, and they had a long list down the wall of all the ways you can make change for a $1 bill. 100 pennies, and so on, and four quarters, and the combinations are. Well, somebody here would have the mathematical ability to figure out very quickly how many ways there are. That is, how many ways there are, but then to write them all out. So a challenge like that, or a big crossword puzzle, poster-sized crossword puzzle that they can work on for a period of a month, something like that. They like a challenge. This was grades, it was 7 and 8, but last year I asked that group. There were, I think there were eight of the students in those grades, and I put a thermometer up on the wall on the first day. That went up to, I believe, 80,000, and I challenged them to try to read 80,000 pages of books that year, 10,000 pages each on the average, and they pushed the mercury out of the top of the thermometer about the end of April, and I did not promise them what I would do. I did tell them a story I'd heard that in one school, a principal challenged his students in the school to read an impossible number of pages and said that if they achieved that, he would spend the night on the roof of the school. And they did. They achieved it, and he spent the night on the roof of the school. Now, they wondered if I was going to do that. I said, no, I wouldn't promise to do that. Our school doesn't have a flat roof. then, of course, so we did this impossible thing, and they did not need to make any reports on there. All I did was had them list the titles of books they had read. And of course, there were a lot of those gruel-type books, were pretty watered-down, thin books. It's like I say, everyone eats some junk food, and I don't mean bad stuff, but kind of thin material. But anyway, they read, and then at the end of the year, wow, what are we going to do about this? Of course, see, this is the problem as a teacher. What do you do? Well, I asked them for suggestions, and they had a suggestion that didn't cost, hardly cost a cent. There was what they really wanted to do, and this was, I'm jumping ahead a little bit here, but into another age group, but they wanted to crawl through a cave that was about maybe 6-7 miles away, and that's fine. Okay, so I found one of our older youth who had been there a number of times was through that. In fact, some of them had been through it before, but they wanted to do it again. And so we went down there and crawled and squeezed and wormed and squirmed through this cave. And to them, that was a wonderful activity. Quite a challenge. Anyway, most children will like a challenge. We had a first grade teacher some years ago who would pique the interest of her first and second graders by saying, now, this would be in science class or health. Now, I'm not sure you can understand this because it's something they don't usually study until seventh grade, but, and then she would proceed to tell them something about the teeth or about the second teeth, and boy, they listen. I mean, if there's anything that, you talk about motivation, if there's anything that motivates you, it's to let you in on a secret that people don't usually understand until they're older. Now, of course, you can't use that too much, or they will get used to it. But if you say that, you better deliver the goods too. You better have something to say. They like team games. They like competition. So it's a good time to do some of those. They like all kinds of adventure, both physical and mental. Now, adventure is a fascinating thing. When's the last time you went on an adventure? An adventure is you travel in territory and you really do not know what's ahead. That's an adventure. I took my group on a walk one time. Now, when you go on a field trip, you want to have been there before, or else it's a place that is set up for school visits, and you know it's a... So if you go to the chip plant, why, you know that they give tours and so on. But if you take them on a walk in the forest or along a railroad track or along the river or something, but one time we went through an area along the railroad, along the river, that an area I had not been before, and I told them that as we started down here. I said, I don't know what's down through here. We're going to find this out together. And that was an adventure, and they enjoyed it. But you can also have adventures in the mind if you go into some subjects or start exploring something and you want to find out something, like one teacher said he would like to use the post-hole method, where through the year, you have a lot of material you want to cover, say in history or in science, but if you just do the survey type of thing and never really sink your teeth into any one subject in depth, they never really find out what it would be like to really do history or do science. And so at some point during the year, it's nice to stop, and wherever you, in an area that you are interested in too, probably in the class, maybe. And so whether that's insects or a particular kind of insect, and you do collections and you collect insects and you study insects, or whether it's a time period in history, say the Black Death or the bubonic plague, and you stop and you find books and you read stories and you find out what you can. And it might be an area that you have not explored yourself. You might not have read that much about yourself. But together, you read and you learn and you find out that, oh, this is a subject we could spend the whole year finding out what it was like during the plague here. And that helps them see that really there's so much. There's so much there to learn. All right, mentally, he tends to actually like history and geography at these ages. He, if it's presented, teach it well. Be sure that there's story there. He likes to learn about far-off places and far-off times. And basically, those are the two things that separate us, time and space. In geography, we study about other places. In history, we study about other times. He likes to collect. Good time for encouraging hobbies of various kinds. Rock collections, insect collections, stamp collections. Some children, all they need is somebody to bring a collection in or to a little suggestion, they will start doing it. It's a worthwhile thing to do. He's inquisitive. Help him to answer his own questions. He reads voraciously. Make sure that some books are provided and have him, encourage him to read good books. And bring books in and read short pieces, short selections, chapter. That's all you need to read from some. You can read a chapter or even just a couple paragraphs out of many books, and that'll be enough to spark their appetite to get their hands on that book and read it. And that way you can introduce them to the book. Give him opportunity in his thinking and reasoning to make some good choices, to think through some choices. Also help him see some of the inconsistencies in some of the decisions or some of the reasoning that he makes. For example, he might say, well, the golden rule says, do good to those who do good to you. So if a person does something to you do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's right. So if he pokes me, why then that's what he wants me to do to him. So it's okay to poke him. Very, very logical, very rational, very reasonable, absolutely tight logic. Right? Do you know what? This is a little aside too. Do you know what the most reasonable thing, one of the most reasonable things that was ever done in the pages of Scripture? These people who like reason, they like to hold reason up as a wonderful thing. One of the most reasonable things that was ever done was when Eve ate the apple. Perfect, perfect reason. Perfect reason. It was good for fruit. It was desired to make one wise. It was very beautiful. I mean, why wouldn't you? Perfect reason. All right, so we'll move on. Help them to see the implications of some of their reasoning. Say, no, wait a minute. just because it's logical, it looks logical, there's more to it than that. He has a good memory. This is an excellent, excellent time to have memory work as a significant part of your curriculum, fourth, fifth, sixth grade. And don't limit it to Bible memory. Excellent time for them to memorize poems, songs, hymns, scripture passages, short speeches, quotations, proverbs, maxims. They'll love it. They'll love it. And these things will stick with them to their aged years. You all know somebody who's 80 years old and can recite things he learned when he was in school. And our students should be able to recite things. The wonderful thing about memorizing something is that you always have it with you. And if you really have it memorized, it is effortless to say it. And it's actually kind of fun. If you really have something memorized, it's kind of fun to recite it and let it roll off your tongue. And some children, if they really have an ability to memorize, encourage them to push them, to memorize some ballads like the Unbarred Door. And they will enjoy going through that whole thing, the whole story. He doesn't understand symbolism well. If you use object lessons, make sure he gets the point. He may very well not get the point you think he's getting. There's the story of the children who made the papier-mâché igloos. And they were studying Eskimos. And so, of course, you do something hands-on because that way you learn best. So they built the igloos out of papier-mâché. And on the test afterward, one of the questions called for the knowledge of what igloos are built of. And guess what the boy put on his test? Papier-mâché. So be sure, if you use something, a very concrete illustration, that they get the point. You might be surprised how they see it. Under social, they can accept responsibility, and so give them some. Give them some leadership in small groups. If you have a little group working on something, appoint a leader to it. Give them little duties around the school. Think up some things like keeping the clock adjusted or making sure that the balls are all in the ball cabinet when they should be. Think of little housekeeping things that can be done and assign some responsibility to them. They're very concerned with fairness, and they perceive fairness as they perceive fairness. Everybody gets the same size of a piece of pie and so on. But they need to learn sooner or later that life is not fair that way. Never was, never will be. And God does not look at fairness like we look at fairness. He has tall people, short people. He has people who seem to have all the troubles, and other people seem to have all the blessings. Other people, their children starving, their children in war-torn lands. We need to learn. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't treat people fairly and impartially. Yes, but they need to learn about that. That's all I can say on that at this point. He doesn't like an authority over him. It's possible to be an authority and to be very influential without throwing your weight around. That is, you can be an authoritative guide without being arbitrary, and he will accept your authority. But you don't have to. You know, there's a way. Sometimes a person can ask you to do something, and the way it's said, you're kind of pleased to do it. But he could ask you to do the same thing in such a way that you'd say, "No, I really would like to do that." But the way you said it, I'm just inclined not to do it. And so, if I told you, "Now you get the ice cream and place it down the road, and everybody eat your Dixie cup right now." Well, that sounds like something fun to do. But why'd you have to say it like that? Well, because it's time to do it, and I'm in charge. Well, now, we wouldn't be that blunt. But on the other hand, if you say, "Well, now, we've been talking for a while, and we all knew the test was coming, so let's take out our paper and I'm ready for the first question." And so even though it's something that's going to be difficult to do, you can do it. So you can be an authority without making it obvious that you are the authority. He likes the gang or the club. Great time for clubs. Secret writing in codes. There's a time period they go through that they like that. Well, you can try to cultivate the idea that the whole class is, in fact, you don't call it a club, but try to play on that by having them include everybody, having an usness in the class. We are a group. we do have an esprit de corps. We are a group. Or if you do some group activities, why, you can have them work in groups. Sometimes you can use that in. They go through the germs period that they're, the girls have germs, the boys stink, the boys, and so on. Do you know what I'm talking about? They dislike the opposite sex. Actually, it seems that this is kind of a period that they go through, that almost when they're young, they play together and think nothing of it, that they almost have to back off a little bit and regroup, and the boys chum and play hard with the boys, and then the kind of later on, they come back together again with a great interest in social activities together in later years. And so there's something natural about that, in terms that the boys will naturally want to talk about boy things and romp and do boy things, but they should not be allowed to develop the attitude that there's something wrong with them, or that they're dirty, or they don't want anything to do with them. That it does not need to descend to that kind of behavior or that kind of attitude. You keep that in mind when you, there are times if you have them working together or doing something that you, if you have a groups of four working, yes, mix the groups, make no big deal out of it. You four do this together and you four do that. And there are other times, use your discretion. It's better perhaps to group them, boys with boys, girls with girls. They really do like heroes, and it's important at this age to be sure that they have some good models. Not only yourself and other people that they know, but also they should be introduced to people, missionary characters like Hudson Taylor, other characters who did important things, including people like Abe Lincoln, not because he was such a wonderful man, but because he did. You can learn much from anyone, actually. And it's possible to learn much from, and they all have all kinds of biographies, really. Don't give them the impression that you can only learn something.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit ChristianLearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the DocForLearning.org.